You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm the editor-in-chief, Rob Weiner Kent, and I'm here with
Associate Editor Deep Tran.
Senior Editor Susie Evans.
And we have a very special edition this time. It's not an issue. I think in terms of issues. But special edition this time. I will admit it's a little late to do a season preview, but it's also our season preview is different from others you might see in that it's the whole season. It's not just a fall preview like the New York Times and other magazines do when they're looking for the fall arts and then do another one in January for the winter. We are looking forward to the entire season. So I thought it would be nice to take a moment. I browsed through our October issue, which has a full listing of all TCG member theaters, to see what plays besides Disgraced and Mr. Burns are coming up that we should take a look at. And I thought we'd go around and have our entire editorial staff weigh in on what particular shows or seasons or developments they're looking forward to in the coming season, which we define as pretty much last September to like next June, let's say, give or take. So, Deep, do you want to kick it off or should I kick it off?
You should kick it off.
I'll kick it off. I was browsing through here and none of them are big surprises to me. They're all things that I've sort of been on my radar, but I just got confirmation by checking through the listings. I want to first highlight, Actors Express Theater in Atlanta. Their season is, when we listed it, I was impressed that they're, I've heard about Freddie Ashley, who runs it, and that company for a while. But in particular, they've got a focus on Atlanta, which is where they're based, in their season. They've got two plays going to run in rep starting October 31st, that week or so, by Steve Yockey, who's from Atlanta. Blackberry Winter, which is a national new play, what's it, new play network?
National Rolling Loop. World Premiere.
Rolling World Premiere. And that's Blackberry Winter. And the other one is The Thrush and Woodpecker. And The Thrush and the Woodpecker by Steve Yockey. They're both sort of family dramas. I think they might be interlinked because Blackberry, not only is Blackberry Winter going to a number of other theaters, but Thrush and the Woodpecker is also going to run and rep at the Kitchen Dog Theater in Dallas next spring, I just discovered. So in any case, I'm impressed with that overall season. Susie, you'd be happy to know that their season closes with Joshua Harmon's significant other. But
big Josh Harmon fan.
In the middle of that, this just came in the mail, actually. I didn't realize they're going to print this. It was a 2014 Yale Drama Series winner. Janine Neighbor's new play, Serial Blackface. Three words. So it's invoking blackface, I think, but I don't think it's about that. And it's going to one of the darkest chapters in Atlanta history. The 1979 through 81 child murders. There was a serial killer. They convicted a guy. He's serving life now, Wayne Williams. I remember when I was old enough to see about it on the news and be freaked out by it. They've written a play that deals peripherally with that. A woman whose son has disappeared and her tense relationship with her own teenage daughter. It's kind of going to one of the darkest chapters of the city's history to tell it to this. It would be, I mean, I suppose it's like Anna DeVere Smith doing the play about the LA riots, but that was still very raw and there's a lot to say about that. This is just really dark. So I salute Actors Express for going there and for really, writing about their, you know, doing what regional theaters are supposed to do, resident theaters are supposed to do, is just reflect their communities. The other two things I'll tell you briefly I'm looking forward to, on a much lighter note, Mary Zimmerman's adaptation of Treasure Island is coming up at Looking Glass. Let me see, when is that? It's coming up in October through January. It is October, so that's going up. And it's going to also run at Berkeley Rep next June. The other thing by her, I'll just squeeze this in, is she's going to do Wonderful Town. She's just did Guys and Dolls at Oregon Shakes. It's a new thing for her to do classic musicals. Usually she adapts things in the room and really shows up on the first day of rehearsal with no script and works these things, adapts them on the spot. With Guys and Dolls, she just did Oregon Shakes and coming up Wonderful Town. She's working with scripted musical. She did it with Candide. She actually worked with a scripted musical there, but she kind of totally adapted it. I think now her new thing is, what can I do with these classics, these classic musicals? So very excited about that. Doug Peck's going to do the music direction. The final thing I said we should all come up with about three things is that La Mama here in New York is about to open a downstairs space, 6,500 square feet, multi-use disciplinary space with a classroom exhibition space and 150 seat performance venue. La Mama has really started a new chapter since Mia Yu took over a couple years ago, and I'm very excited to see what work will go on there. I've heard it's going to be a space for more community collaborations and co-productions, which sounds exciting. And when I put out a query to various people about what they're looking forward to, I heard about this from a lot of people. So I'm also looking forward to it, and we'll be watching that and probably writing about it. So those are the things I'm looking forward to for this season. And that opens November 6th, the new La Mama space with a puppet show, the name of which I don't have here. Deep, what do you got?
Alrighty then. My three recommendations, the first one that came to my mind immediately was Lucas Nate's new play at Victory Gardens. It's going to run April 1st to May 1st, 2016, and it's called Hillary and Clinton. And it's a imagining of a night in the life of Hillary Clinton during her presidential campaign.
2008.
In 2008, yeah. Yes. Which not her presidential campaign in 2016, because Lucas is very talented, but he is not a, like a Nostradamus type.
He is not a soothsayer, right?
Yeah, soothsayer. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be very appropriate since she's probably going to be the Democratic nominee unless Bernie Sanders comes up behind her.
Never know.
So now I know who Rob might be voting for in the primaries.
No, not really.
This is not a political podcast.
We probably will be writing about that one too, but go on.
Yes, yes. And my next recommendation is also political in nature. It's Lisa Loomer's newest play at OSF. It's at Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
Right.
My apologies.
That's right.
It's called Roe. It's about Roe versus Wade, and it's part of their American Revolution's commissioning cycle, which commissions plays based on U.S. history. Mm-hmm. And so that will be running, if I can find the date on this.
You know what's interesting about that, while you look for the date, interesting about that play, I've spoken to her about it. It's about Norma McCorvey, who was the woman that was assigned the name Roe and as in the like anonymous name in the case. And you know what happened with Norma McCorvey, right? In the 80s she became a born again Christian. Now she's a virulent anti-abortion, anti-choice activist. So Lisa wants to put a play on the stage that puts both points of view as much as possible. As she put it, without people running screaming from the room. But so I think she wants to represent, you know, both sides of the debate, yeah. Which is a bold move.
Right, and then maybe in the sequel she can write about the Planned Parenthood hearing that just happened.
Sure.
So that'd be interesting. It's also prescient because of all of these legislation that's being thrown around about defunding Planned Parenthood. And so Roe is running April 20th to October 29th, 2016. And coincidentally, OSF is going to be producing Viet Gone by Quy Nguyen. And I will be seeing that play next week when I go to South Coast Rep just for home and for the Without Walls Festival at La Jolla Playhouse, the Festival of Site-Specific Theater. So I'm very excited because I feel like I've been living with this play for 7 months because I've written now, I think, three pieces, AT and freelance, about Viet Gone. So I'm very excited for that.
Right. You wrote about it when you went to the Pacific Playwrights Festival last spring, right?
Yes.
And saw it there. Yeah. Great. It's very exciting that Quy's getting those productions.
Yes.
Elsewhere.
He's a full grown playwright now, mm-hmm, though he won't admit it. And
get a little gray in the hair.
A little gray, but that's what happens when you have two small kids.
Tell me about it.
And my third thing that I'm looking forward to is Neighborhood 3, Requisition of Doom by mm-hmm. Jennifer Haley at the Flea Theater. It made its world premiere at the Humana Festival of New American Plays in 2012,
13. I think I saw some of it, yeah.
I will verify that when I interview Jennifer Haley for the article. I will be writing about her in our December issue. So that's running on November 9th to December 21st, 2015. And it's about an RPG
game. Yeah, get it straight, RPG. Use the right
that takes over the lives of these teenagers, right, okay. Which is very exciting. And as part of the production, the Flea Theater will be doing a live RPG-type game in Chelsea. So that might be interesting.
Isn't all theater a role-playing game?
Especially immersive theater where you can pick your own adventure.
Those are good recommendations. I was just going to – I happened to notice that Philadelphia Theater Company, a shout-out, is doing Hillary and Clinton May, June, right after its Victory Gardens run. So lots of chances to see that in an election year. Hopefully it won't be anticlimactic. Susie, what you got?
I'm really looking forward to it. I'm a big fan of American Repertory Theater up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but I've never gotten to check out their Oberon space, which I've heard is very cool. And their lineup for this season looks really, really cool. I mean, Ghost Quartet, Dave Malloy's little chamber musical just played there, which I got to see at the McKittrick Hotel, which was great. It probably was cool in that space. Opening, I guess, tonight is Todd Allman's Kansas City Choir Boy, which features Courtney Love and Todd Allman with music and lyrics.
I saw that in January when it played at the Prototype Festival.
Yeah, it sold out at the Prototype Festival immediately. I didn't see it, and apparently it's amazing, and this Oberon space sounds like a really cool place to see it in, so I wish I could see it. Well, Deepta is waving her hand weirdly, but I like Todd Allman a lot, and it's fun. I'm not a big immersive or experimental theater person, but Oberon feels like something that's like right up my alley, where it's like a nice marriage between the two.
Well, it's not really immersive. I mean, the Kansas City Choir Boy was in – it was just in a tiny space.
Oberon is an immersive space.
I mean, it's a flexible space. So you can really do anything in that
space. It's more of a club space.
It's a little bit more clubby. I mean, the Donkey – it's famous for the Donkey Show. I mean, Sean Graney's latest Gilbert and Sullivan show, HMS Pinafore, is coming there, which we wrote about. I didn't get to see it in Chicago, but they did it in rep with the Mikado and Pirates of Penzance. Pirates of Penzance has already been at ART, but that looks great. They're doing We're Gonna Die with Company One. I didn't get to see that in New York. There's just really cool things happening at Oberon.
I wonder if it's going to be with Young Gene doing it, right?
Yeah, Company One's producing it. Sean LeCount's directing it. That's going to be in April 2016. Gilbert and Sullivan's in March 2016. The Todd Allman, Courtney Love thing's happening right now, so go see it. Yeah, so lots of good stuff. I've never checked out that space, but it looks like they have a good season. Deep mentioning Viet Gong and Southern California reminded me that my favorite playwright, Becca Brunstetter, has a new play coming to South Coast Rep called Going to a Place Where You Already Are. I think Deep saw it in a reading series, but I'm a big fan of Becca. She hasn't had a new play in a while because she's been writing for TV for Switched at Birth. And she was supposed to have a show at Roundabout last season, but it got moved for some reason. So I'm super excited that she has a new play coming out. And hopefully I'll get to go out and see it or maybe do something with Becca because it's been a long time since she's been on the stage. Super excited about that play. I'm also really excited to see Sweat at Arena Stage from OSF. I've heard really good things about it. I know Rob got to see it. I think that's coming in February.
Lynn Hodges play. And it's almost definitely coming to a New York theater not yet named.
Well, yeah, it'll probably be in New York. It got super big raves. We'll all get to see it. But it's coming to Arena Stage because it was a co-production with OSF.
Right.
And then just announced today, I was really excited about this play already, and now I'm even more excited, is Sarah Burgess's Dry Powder at the Public.
Why would you be excited about that, perhaps?
I was excited about it before. I have a copy of the play. I've read part of it.
Okay.
I have old ancestors named Sarah Burgess, so we're probably related, so, you know.
Okay.
But, you know, John Krasinski from The Office is going to star in it and make his New York theatrical debut, so pretty
Mind
excited about that.
No, ladies. No.
I was excited about it before they announced
all
John
right,
Krasinski.
All right. Hey, a little celebrity in the right place.
Yeah, it's a big deal for Sarah, too. This is like her first big production in New York. She's been, you know, emerging for a while. It's big to have it at the Public, big to have John Krasinski. You know, she's probably my long-lost cousin, so maybe she can introduce me.
There you go. We have with us today also our new production editor, Russ Denben. Do you have some things you're looking forward to as well?
I definitely do. Thanks, Rob.
Tell us about them.
I will. I'm really looking forward to Alice in Wonderland, which is an immersive promenade adaptation of the Lewis Carroll books by the collective Underbelly, which I think is still based in Austin, a bunch of UT grads and such. The show will be at Zach Theater in Austin in March through May, and it's going to be staged in various parts of Zach's big campus, so that's pretty exciting.
Cool.
And then it's also part of the New Victory LabWorks program in New York.
So, oh, really? Really? So, okay.
So probably come here as well.
If it's age appropriate, my kids might see it, right?
Yes.
I don't know if it's age appropriate.
Yes.
But,
I think so. We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see.
Cool. Yeah, what lot- age inappropriate about doing drugs with a caterpillar?
Right? It depends on whether it's metaphorical drugs or actual drugs.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's right. And there have been a lot of these immersive and promenade stagings of those stories. So
it does seem like Then She Fell is an Alice in Wonderland.
That's right. Yeah. And then there's one in London as well. Alice Underground.
Wow.
Yep.
It does seem like a natural fit for,
yes.
that, for that tale. Episodic. Yeah. And trippy.
And it's the 150th anniversary of the first book.
Did not know that.
Yeah. So there you go. I'm also excited about Sarah Roll's new piece for Peter Pan on her 70th birthday, which is going to be at the Humana Festival of New American Plays in March through April, and then Berkeley Rep May through July.
Sounds good. That's going to have Kathleen Chalfant flying.
Yes.
Is the shorthand. The play where Kathleen Chalfant flies.
Yes. Good times.
Les Waters directing, I believe.
Yes.
I might have a chance to see that if it's my turn to go see
it. It's your turn.
I think it is. And they're going for their 30th anniversary, so it's going to be a giant party.
Anniversaries, I don't see anniversaries.
I'm blind to them. 40th, my bad.
Yeah. Now, we also have our editorial assistant, Allison, who was grimacing when Russ mentioned that last. That's a play you're also looking forward to, is
it
that right?
It was, yeah.
Was on your
that's
list?
That's what happens when you go last.
I'm sorry.
I've got one recommendation left. I'm really looking forward to Bedlam Theater here in New York City is doing the New York premiere of New York Animals. It's by Steven Saylor, and it's featuring music by Burt Bacharach.
Wow.
It is opening November 14th at the New Ohio Theater. The play is about 21 New Yorkers whose lives intertwine on a rainy day in New York City. And there's only four actors, which is nothing new for Bedlam Theater. I think they did St. Joan last year with four actors and 24 characters. So it'll be very inventive, and I'm looking forward to that.
Did St. Joan a rep with Hamlet or something like that? Or am I have had that wrong? They did.
I don't think it was with
they
Hamlet.
They did a Shakespeare play with a very few people too, I think. Or maybe I'm completely...
They did. I'm trying to think. They just did Sense and Sensibility last season, and
I've heard great things about them. And I've not seen their work. And Ben Brandt.
Yeah, I always hear really good things. I've never seen them either.
They may have been here.
Wait, I know one more that you're probably looking forward to.
What am I looking forward to?
Climbing with Tigers.
Oh, absolutely.
Salt Lake City.
Yes.
Acting. Climbing with Tigers.
There you go.
Salt Lake Acting Company. It's going to be from March 4th to the 26th.
Well, tell me about it.
And it is about. It was written by an 8-year-old boy who has brittle bones. Disease. So it was a book that is being adapted into a play. And so the story is about a little blackbird named Blue who one day dreams of flying. And part of his dreams is this fantasy world of dragons and tigers. And it's just supposed to be very imaginative and beautiful.
Yeah. And they're doing it with it's Salt Lake Acting Company doing it with a new, company called Flying Bobcat Laboratory, which is like an emerging company in Salt Lake City, and they're going to do really cool projections, and it's going to be cool.
Right. And they're also working with Red Fred Project, who I believe helped create the book.
Right. Backtracking to that Bacharach thing sounds only vaguely familiar. Is that a new score by him with lyrics by Steven Sater?
I believe so.
It's not like old Bacharach songs repurposed?
From what I understand, Steven Sater wrote this play and with the intention of it being not a play. He wrote it with the intention of it being on TV and it never happened.
Right.
But the he still had the rights for it, and it's been a long, like, 8-year project, I think. But from what I understand, it's all original music by Burt Bacharach.
Wow. So, I know that Burt Bacharach is supposedly working on a Broadway musical of Painted from Memory, the album he did with Elvis Costello, and that they've written a bunch of new songs, and that Chuck Lorre of 2.5 Men fame is writing the book. So,
well, I'm surprised he's still kicking around, and I feel like he'd be richer than God by now.
I don't know. It's about
find
money.
Some way to spend your days.
I saw him at the New York Theater Workshop.
Yeah, I saw that too.
And he was there the day I was there. He's in good shape. He's very enthusiastic. I spoke to him about it. He's very excited. I think he's still gets up and wants to make music, I guess. So, Burt Bacharach, great. So, there's your season. That's all you need to know about it. No, keep reading American Theater. We're going to talk more about the season as it goes.
Wait, your mention of New York Theater Workshop and Burt Bacharach reminded me that the David Bowie musical Lazarus is coming to New York Theater Workshop.
Well,
super
I would just
excited
say,
about that.
If I squeezed in one more, I didn't want to go too much into New York, but their season. I won't say anything bad about last season. We were very excited about the public. this season that the public is very interesting. But I will say that New York Theater Workshop, their season, their entire season, is looks amazing. Not just the play I'm going to see this week, the Sybil Kempson with ERS, finally Colette Richland, I'm seeing it this week. Then Lazarus, by the way. Then Red Speedo, Lucas Nath.
I've seen that one.
The ubiquitous Lucas Nath. And Hadestown, which Rachel Travkin's writing. You wrote a little bit about, you wrote a great piece about Rachel and mentioned that piece. Hadestown, like Futurity, another musical that's finally making its New York debut, is a sort of band-driven. I mean, Anais Mitchell's going to be in this show, right?
No, she's not in the show. She just composed the music for it and,
well, that just
and worked with Rachel on the libretto.
Refutes my entire thesis.
Rachel wrote the libretto?
No. She helped Anais develop the libretto. So she gets a development credit.
Refutes my thesis. I mean, I was talking – earlier workshops had Anais and her band were telling the story. You know, it's like the Ghost Quartet model where it's the band is the play, is the actors – are the actors. It's all intertwined. And Futurity, I think, is going to be that with Cesar and Alvarez and the Lisps. I'm pretty sure he's in it. Anyway, that's left for us to see. We also have in this show, I should have teased at the beginning, an interview with Serenby Playhouse Artistic Director Brian Cloudis. Deep?
Yes. Brian was in New York City because Serenby was one of the 12 recipients of the American Theater Wing's National Theater Company grant. They're like a bunch of $10,000 grants. So he was in for that. And Serenby Playhouse, we featured them in our September 2015 production notebook. Their production of A Streetcar Named Desire set outside in a bunch of shipping containers. Some of our readers were very unhappy with that treatment of Tennessee Williams. And so Brian talks a lot about reinventing classics because that's what he does at Serenby. They do a bunch of classics in site-specific locations.
Cool. And they're also featured in the October issue. His sister,
yes.
Brianne Cloudis. Their parents had a great sense of humor naming them. Her photos are kind of what got our attention. I mean, we've certainly heard of the company, but her photos are so beautiful. They're featured in a special article about production photography.
Right. And so if you ever want to get American Theater's attention on your work, invest in very good production photographers.
Get a good photographer. So why don't we go
over to... You want anybody's attention.
That's true.
Basically, yes.
But especially ours.
We're very shallow people.
Yes. Let's go over to that interview now with Brian Cloudis.
Hello. Today we're sitting down with Brian Cloudis, the founder and artistic director of Serenby Playhouse in Atlanta, Georgia. Hello, Brian.
Howdy.
So what brings you to town today?
So Serenby Playhouse just won one of the 12 American Theater Wing grants, and they flew us up yesterday for the ceremony. And we're taking advantage of being here for 48 hours and reached out to you at American Theater Magazine after our 2-page spread we just had and asked if we could meet up, and here we are. So it's good to finally meet you.
It's good to meet you too. We're friends on Facebook, so now it's less creepy.
It's less weird now, definitely. we had to make it official and meet in person.
Well, and I appreciate you stopping by and recording this with us. Actually, we had some comments on that spread on Facebook.
I know.
You noticed that, right?
I sort of live for all that, you know? definitely. And my thing is, like, I always love controversy, and I would rather create theater that's sparking conversation as opposed to a post that doesn't get many likes or comments. You know what I mean? But definitely the visuals from that production, you know, struck some chords. And for me, I think, you know, I don't treat material preciously. I was like, it's a classic. It's Tennessee Williams. But I want to reinvent it for a new audience and, again, create theater that's accessible to young people. We saw a lot of young people in that audience who would probably never see a Tennessee Williams regardless. And I went into that production knowing very well Tennessee Williams purists were going to get their butt on their shoulders and be mad about it, you know? But I was like, hey, people are talking about it. It was a sold out run and it was our biggest play to date. So, and we're in American Theater Magazine over it.
I live for site-specific immersive work. And so when I heard about this company in Georgia that's doing site-specific musicals and plays, I thought, oh my God, I need to go see this one of these days.
You've got to come. I told you, open invitation anytime you want to come see it. So
yeah, but I'm sure you must be used to controversy just because like you do specialize in reimagining classics, like you did Oklahoma in a Barn, and you just did Evita in The Round. It was in The Round.
Right? It was in The Round. Yeah, I mean, you know, initially when we started doing this, you know, I would take things very personally, and those kind of like Facebook comments from the purists would kind of, oh, like, you know, hurt my feelings, or I would take it personally. But again, it's like, you know, after we did Oklahoma, and that was the one we really reinvented first. You know, we did Hair that previous year in a Wildflower Meadow, and it was like Woodstock, but it was still pretty true to like how people, you know, seen Hair before besides it's being outside. But when we did Oklahoma, we really pushed the boundaries on how sexy we made it and how dark we made it. But going back to that material, the material is really dark and really weird. And when that came out in its time, it rattled people, really rattled people. You know, you've got Aunt Eller, who's a matriarch. I mean, when do you see that? You know, she led that family. And then you've got Judd, you know, watching porn up in his lair, you know, like lusting after Lori. And then you've got Ado Annie, who's basically a big old slut. You know, I mean, she just can't say no. So we really pushed the boundaries on that show, and that was clear in our marketing materials. And that was the first show we got that kind of rattled people, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein purist. But I think when people saw the amount of people that were coming to see what we were doing, and, you know, materials meant to be reinvented and have, you know, fresh breath kind of blown into it. So it is accessible. It's not the same audience as when it was created. So I think the thing is to have new audiences watching this classic work. And that's what we've really become known for in the past couple of years, is taking these iconic classics and really shaking them up in site-specific outdoor environments, you know? Because the funny thing is, like, Shakespeare does that all the time, right?
Right.
Like
we do it with Shakespeare.
People are not shocked about seeing Shakespeare or a classic opera completely reinvented, but for some reason, these, like, you know, within the past 100 years, this, you know, it's still kind of touch and go of how you can really reinvent things. And my thing is, as long as you're true to the text and you don't change the text, the material speaks for itself, and you can put it in a new location or a new kind of timeless environment. So for me, it's always like, I'm very text-based director of like, what can we do to serve this text for our audience? Our audience we've cultivated is not interested in seeing Tennessee Williams like it's been done. They come knowing we're going to put it in shipping containers, mm-hmm. or put it in this timeless kind of environment.
Right. Well, what kind of audiences do you have? Is it mostly young people? Is it a diverse audience? Like, what's the demographic?
Yeah, we have a really diverse audience, but we do take a lot of pride of having a younger audience that doesn't go to theater. You know, we've cultivated that through creating a sense of event and a sense of, you know, total immersion experience. And the funny thing is that we only have 5% of our audience from our zip code, which is, you know, Serenbe and Chattahoochee Hills area, which is a very small community. So we're bringing in 95% of our audience from greater metro Atlanta and even within the surrounding states. So mm-hmm. people are now seeking out Serenbe Playhouse as a destination to discover the Serenbe community and to see what we're doing that other companies in our area or not. And now that we're finding out, you know, we're unique nationally with, you know, the American Theater Magazine press that we got and the Playbill press this year, and now American Theater Wing, it's just like, oh my God, what's next? You know, we're literally on cloud nine. So,
well, since we're all friends on Facebook, I did see your post about how you may be winning the regional theater Tony.
I'm all about putting it out there, you know, but the funny thing is, before the ceremony last night, they sent an email saying, just so you know, you're going to be making speeches and you should prepare a speech as if you're winning the regional Tony Award. And I was like, oh my God, I was like, the American Theater Wing knows who we are now. This is like the first step towards winning a regional Tony. And I even created a hashtag. I said regional Tony next, because I firmly believe that if you create work that's relevant and creates a new audience and provides opportunities for artists, you know, emerging and established, that people are, they're starting to take notice now. So if we stay on this trajectory, regional Tony's not too far away. I'm just putting it out there, you know?
Wait, so if people want to support you in this campaign, what should they do?
Well, they should tell me who all their friends are on the American Theater Wing board that I could try to flirt with. No, I mean, I think...
Buy them down, get them drunk.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not above it at all. But I think to support us on this campaign is to support the work we're doing. You know, come see what we're doing. I mean, Atlanta's the largest airport in the country. It's not expensive to take a flight in, you know?
Yeah, and it's hot right now with The Walking Dead and what else?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Atlanta is the second film and TV community in the nation now. So you've got so many artists moving from New York and LA to make Atlanta their artistic home because, you know, Walking Dead's filmed there. There's so much happening. There's like all, Vampire Diaries is filmed there. That's how we were able to get Matt Davis, who starred in Streetcar Named Desire. So it's really, it's a hot community now, you know?
Wait, so just so I can get a sense of the metro Atlanta area, mm-hmm. where are you located from Atlanta proper?
So we're located 35 minutes southwest of Atlanta proper, but we're about 15 minutes from Atlanta airport. So you've got a lot of people who live in Serenbee who are commuters as well. So yeah, we're about 35 minutes southwest of Atlanta, but still in the same county, Fulton County. And, you know, Atlanta Metro Theater is very interesting because it's very spread out. So we're still an Atlanta Metro Theater. Metro Atlanta is so spread out. So inherently the theaters are spread out as well. So you've got, you know, a theater in Lawrenceville, which is, you know, 45 minutes north of the city. And then you've got us, you know, 40 or 35 minutes south of the city. So it's really spread out. But it's exciting because, you know, and you've got actors who work at all of these companies. So.
Right. Well, they must be dedicated just because I've heard from people who live in Atlanta that the traffic is horrendous.
It really is pretty bad. But again, you have to be smart about when you're on the road. There's certain times that you cannot be on the road. You know, and Gretchen, our managing director, who's sitting beside me here, I mean, you know, she lives, you know, an hour outside of Serenbee, but she knows when she can be on the road and when she can't. So if she's coming to the office, she's like, hey, you know, I'm coming in at this time, or hey, I'm going to like leave now to get on the road. So you just have to be smart about when you're on the road. But it's not as bad as LA, I've heard. So
yeah, I went to school in LA and there, and I would just not drive between the hours of 3 and 7.
You just know not to.
Noon, just because. Yeah. You're just wasting all like, most of your life in traffic.
Exactly. So you have to be smart. And actually, I live in Serenbee now. So this year, I moved to the community full time. I used to split my time between Atlanta, you know, Midtown and Atlanta and Serenbee. But now I made the plunge and moved there full time. So my commute's very easy.
Wait, so what made you decide? I mean, you're from the area. So what made you decide to come back and start a theater? Because Serenbee's only 5 years old.
So the community is 10 years old.
I mean, the playhouse.
Yeah, so we're in our sixth season. So we're 6 years old. And I'll give you kind of the Cliff Notes story. But I was in New York as a professional actor and just kind of missed my family. Had also been an undergrad, you know, in the Northeast. And I was hungry to get back to my Southeast roots. So I decided to pursue graduate studies in the Southeast. So I moved back to the Southeast to start my MFA at the University of South Carolina. And my sister and her family live in Atlanta. And they discovered the Serenbee community. And they said, you've got to come check this place out. You're going to fall in love with it. I did fall in love with it. And I shot a random email to the community, not knowing a soul, and pitched the idea of a theater company. And lo and behold, they somehow bought it. And, you know, the first thing they said is that there's no indoor space to produce theater. And I said, well, let's just do it outside and see if people like it. So we started the first season producing really small scale shows in site-specific environments. And people really hooked into it. So then for the second season, I said, well, let's shake it up and do all new locations. And then after our third season, we became an exclusively outdoor site-specific environment. And then in season 4, we produced Hair, and we did it in a wildflower meadow and set up like a hippie commune and had a hippie bus out there and old vintage scaffolding. So when people came in, it was basically like a small version of Woodstock. And that's the show that really blew us out of the water. And we saw our ticket sales just catapult. And after that season, it was like, oh, we have something really special here. And then we started capitalizing on doing reinvented big classic works. So.
And just from a monetary point of view, does the lack of having to pay rent for a theater, like, does it enable you to mount these big shows? Because most new theaters, they usually do new plays or small scale work so that it's cheaper to produce overall.
Yeah. I mean, there is definitely an advantage of not having a mortgage and not having a lot of overhead costs, but also there's a lot of cost to set up these venues. So we set up a new theater every time we produce a play. We're renting a generator. We're trying to figure out where to run power, a ton of cabling, you know, you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So we're literally setting up a new venue. For the first 3 years, we really produced really small scale work, and we finished each year in a financial surplus, and we kind of worked up, you know, and when we did Hair, we had so much money that we brought in from just ticket revenue alone that we were able to make those baby steps of doing, you know, it bigger and bigger each year. Cause then Oklahoma was just a step up from Hair, and then Evita, we really stepped it up. But then again, the payoff was great because it was our most financially successful musical ever. So again, as a new company, you can't do Evita in year one. You can do it in year six if you're smart about how you program and save money. You know, theater, it's a nonprofit, but it's also a business. It's what, you know, Gretchen really hypes on as well. It's like, you know, if you're not making money, there's a reason you're not. You need to find out why your audience is not buying tickets. It's an audience-driven art form, not an artist-driven art form, you know? So I'll get on my soapbox about that. I mean, you have to listen to your audience. What does your audience want to see? It's not I'm going to start a theater company, just produce what I want to see. It's like, what does my audience want to see? And it takes a few years to figure that out, you know?
Right. But then how did you know that this is what the audience wanted?
Because tickets were selling.
I mean, let's say your first year, you want to create this theater company, you want to do musicals, but then how'd you know there was a community for site-specific musicals?
Well, the first year, it was just like a prayer and a wing. I was just figuring it out as I went along. And, I mean, you know, I picked material I was passionate about, but that seemed to make sense with what the community's mission was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from day one, we knew we wanted to create a theater company that went in line with Serenby's mission of art, nature, and community, connecting those three elements. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, chose three. We did Jungle Book for our family show, and then we did Shakespeare's R&J, four-person, you know, Joe Clarko's version of Romeo and Juliet, and then we did John and Jen the musical. And all three of those kind of developed a specific audience, and we saw early on that our family series was a huge moneymaker for us, and that community really wanted to see high-quality family theater. So we really produce our family show as just as important as most of our main stage shows, because that runs for, you know, over 2 months throughout the summer, and people come back multiple times to see that. And then, you know, then a certain part of our audience latched on to a drama. So we kept that going. And then our musical, of course, like most theaters, that was the one we always saw the most ticket sales for. So that's the one we thought we could take more risk on, you know?
Right.
But it was interesting this year doing A Streetcar Named Desire, which was the first like big name play we did. And we also put a TV star in it. I mean, that sold out like nobody's business. But again, for me, it's not about, oh, we're going to do a show for a title, but Streetcar Named Desire in Atlanta in the summer, it just makes sense, you know?
Right. You need that sense of humidity so that you know why the characters are so freaking cranky.
They are burning up and they're shoved in a small apartment. Of course they're cranky. bless their hearts.
Bless those actors. Bless. They suffered.
They suffer for their art form.
Especially when you're doing site-specific work in Atlanta heat. Like, I don't even know how your actors did Hair and have to, well, like, they get naked, so that's fine.
They just took all their clothes off when they got hot. But, you know, I mean, Atlanta is really hot during the day, but once the sun goes down, it really does cool off. So, yeah, but also, I'm used to it at this point. And, you know, I'm like a lot of directors, like, I have a core group of actors I love using that really get the environment and get, you know, the work we're doing. It's definitely not, it's not a theater for divas, because if you're asking me where the dressing room is in a barn, we're going to have an issue. I was like, you know, you just got to duck down and take that top off quickly and hop back on the stage. But the performers who really get it say, you know, there's nothing like standing on a stage and looking up at the stars and the moon. You know, it's something you can't accomplish indoors.
Right. And also, it's not like you're flying actors down from New York City who aren't used to the heat. It's mostly Atlanta talent, too.
It is mostly. But again, you know, as we grow, we're starting to bring in more New York people. You know, we brought in a Broadway actor, Charlie Brady, this year to play Che in Evita. But we had a long conversation about the work, and he was excited about it. Mm-hmm. And he loved what we were doing and wanted to be a part of it. You know, so again, there's a vetting process, and we're bringing a New York director in, Julie Lord, who teaches at Juilliard, and I've known her for a few years, and she's very interested in what we're doing, as opposed to, oh, I just want a job, you know? Again, mm-hmm. There's a vetting process of, like, we really are outside. It really is Atlanta. It really is hot. There's mosquitoes. But again, all of that stuff just fades away when you see the work and you're involved in the work.
Right. I mean, I've talked to so many artists who do site-specific immersive work, and I feel like the common denominator between all of them, besides the, you know, this is atypical theater, you know, setup, it's also they make theater an event, and therefore they get a lot of young people, a lot of atypical audiences into that. And so do you see that as a future of theater, which is not so much, you know, sit down, put your phone away, be on your best behavior, but we're going to make something that you've never experienced before?
I do think it's the new wave of theater. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, I love indoor theater as well. I love going to see, you know, I love seeing everything. But I think our new audience is one that is going to come because there's a sense of event and something that we can accomplish on film and TV. You know, film and TV is our huge competitor now as theater producers. And by producing something that they cannot get, something that is directly interactive, something that breaks down the fourth wall, where they don't even think about their cell phone. You know what I mean? That's what, when we have, you know, theater that we're producing that has them on their feet and walking around, they don't even think about their cell phone because they're so invested in the event, you know? So it is producing that sense of event. But again, I think that can be done with any kind of material. You know, I think a lot of site-specific work is like, oh, it has to be really experimental and avant-garde and for like a really artsy, you know, fun, hip crowd. But I think, Oklahoma can be immersive. And, you know, we're doing Carousel as our first musical next season, and we're creating an actual fair. So we're having fair rides come in, so audiences will be able to ride fair rides, get cotton candy, funnel cakes, and they sit down and watch a classic Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. But again, that gets an audience in the door that would never come in with just seeing Carousel, you know?
Right. I mean, because then it makes it something that is fresh, and it doesn't seem like you're stodgy. So the stodgy association you get usually when you hear Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Right. People are like, oh Lord, another Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, but I've really fallen in love with Rodgers and Hammerstein work. You know, South Pacific was my first professional show as an actor in
Summer's. Who did you play?
I was Stew Pot.
Of course you were Stew Pot. I was going to say Stew Pot.
Stew Pot.
Did you wear the crop top too?
Yeah. And I was like so lanky and tall. So yeah, I have a special place for that work. But again, you know, I keep harping on this, but people forget how revolutionary that work was.
Of course.
When it was written, you know, and classic work is meant to be reinvented or it sadly goes away. And that's why Shakespeare's still relevant, because it's constantly fresh and for a new audience.
And I was talking to Bartlett Sher about this, because I'm so glad you brought up South Pacific, because I am, you know, writing a long form piece that explores like R&H's, you know, cool political stances when they were writing these musicals and what they intended versus what has been done after.
Right.
And Bartlett was talking about how when you're looking at this work in 2015, like South Pacific and King and I, which is kind of racially problematic as books, you need to reinterpret them for this lens. You need to up the racial language. You need to ask these big questions of the audience about race and about alienation and about, you know, interracial relationships and like these important questions, as opposed to just putting it up there like it's 1950s and you're going to have a great time in the theater.
Correct. And you know, you always have to think about when are you producing this work and who your audience is. And I mean, you know, all this controversy around the Mikado that just got canceled.
Yes.
And I think it's exciting that theater is creating these questions about race and all of these things. I mean, that's what we want, right? We want people talking. Mm-hmm. You know, we're doing Miss Saigon next year. So we had a conversation last night about what does it mean to be producing Miss Saigon now, you know, 20 years or 25 years after. And I mean, when Miss Saigon was originally done, Jonathan Pryce, a Caucasian, you know, British guy, played the engineer, and people picketed that show. They were PO'd, you know? So we have a commitment to casting actual Asian Americans in these roles that don't get roles. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, but you do have to think about how do you make it relevant and not racist or offensive in 2015 or 2016, you know? But I think that's exciting.
I wrote a piece about the Mikado, and everyone was saying, actually, not everyone. I misspoke.
Every person, right?
Everyone. Yes, every person of a certain stripe. No.
Right.
Just like some people were saying that this is how it's traditionally done and we should preserve this tradition of performance. But then you think, but theater is a dynamic art form. It needs to change. Otherwise, it dies. And so why do we pick and choose what traditions of the art form we preserve?
Yeah. Not great.
That's been very odd. It's been an odd week
for me. Yeah. But hey, again, it's good to be talked about, right? Because people are listening to your voice. Even if they don't agree with you, I think it's interesting because then people get on like this bandwagon. But again, how exciting that theater is still creating this much passion and controversy, you know?
Right. And there's a lot of racist people who like Gilbert and Sullivan.
There really is, you know? But again, you know, we had a friend who came and saw the ceremony last night. She was talking about, you know, that some of that music is really beautiful. There is a mm-hmm. way to, you know, not make it stereotypical and offensive. Like, there would be a way to reinvent it. It would take a little bit of work, but how exciting to see a Mikado that's not, you know, played by Caucasian people in geisha makeup, making fun of, like, you know, making fun of them. Right. So
you should do that and show them how it's done.
I'm putting it out there. Call me. I'll direct it and reinvent it. It all happened on her podcast.
Yes, well, if it's on the internet, it must be true.
It must be true.
Wait, so veering away from the representation issue, but for you as an actor, there's not many actors who run theater companies. And so has that been a deviation from your normal, from what you were trained to do?
Yeah, I mean, all of my training's in acting, even my graduate degree's in MFA in acting. But for me, I learned so much about being a director and producer from directors and producers I worked with. I learned what I would never want to do to actors, and I learned what, for me as an actor, really helped me soar. So when I started the company, I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to act like producers I liked and directors that I liked. So I learned so much about actually my directing and producing from, you know, my acting mentors. And again, you know, I've found some of the most amazing directors I've worked with are also still working actors. But again, you know, I'm on stage right now playing Frankenfurter in Rocky Horror at Warehouse mm-hmm. Theater. But I haven't been on stage in 2 years because all of my energy had to go to Serenby Playhouse. It was that pivotal time of like, oh my God, this is it. Literally the next 2 years, I'm going to eat, breathe, and sleep this company. But also, you know, now we're in a staff size where I have Gretchen here with me, and she can keep an eye on things while I go to Greenville for a couple of months and do a gig. But for me, that's, I forgot how important being on stage is for me because it kind of like revamped my soul. It is, I mean, I love directing and I love producing work, but there is a sense of relief when you walk into rehearsal and it's like, oh my God, I'm just acting. I'm just here to do my one thing and nobody's asking me 25 questions. But then also it's like, you know, as an actor, it's like, oh no, I was like, should I say something? I have an idea. And I was like, no, that's not my, you know, it's not my job to like make lighting design suggestions. But yeah, I mean, and you know, we see in Atlanta, there are, you know, a handful of artistic directors who still act. Mm-hmm. And you know, in the regional theater scene, you kind of do it all. You know, it's like there's a lot of educators who also act and, you know, you kind of wear multiple hats to make a full-time career out of being an artist. So,
right. But when I see like artistic directors of like mid-budget size theater, mid-level budgets to like high budgets, they're usually directors who became artistic directors. Like that's usually a natural progression
correct.
Of a career.
But I guarantee you they were actors before they became directors. Didn't we all start and, you know, we're all in shows in high school? Yeah, I mean, typically it is a director who's now become an artistic director. And definitely in Atlanta now, people really see me as a director, producer. Mm. So I was excited when I was like, had an opportunity as an actor to go back on stage. But again, like I'm not an actor who's like actively auditioning or like, oh, I've got to like act this year. If something pops up, oh, sure, that's fun. I'll go play, you know, Frankenfurter and Rocky Horror Show for a month or two. But for me, it's not like I have to get a show, you know, every couple of months. I mean, you know, my baby is Serenby Playhouse and, you know, I'm much more of a director, producer now, but every couple of years, you got to be a tranny, you know?
Can I quote you on that? That was
of course you can. And I'll send you photos, too, of me as a tranny.
Oh, I've seen that.
You've seen that. Yeah. That's right. We're Facebook buds.
Yes, and I saw you trying to figure out how to wave a baton and walk into
I knew how to twirl a baton.
Oh, okay.
That's a skill I learned as a little boy in Alabama. I was obsessed with majorettes in the marching band. So, like, my ultimate dream in life was to be a majorette because you could wear, like, a sparkly bathing suit and go-go boots and twirl batons.
And walk in the front.
And they lead the band in, you know? Oh, it was nothing more glamorous. So, my granny bought me batons when I was, like, a child. And I would go behind the house every day and figure out how to twirl those batons. And now I've twirled them, like, three times in shows. It's like a special. I was like, hey, I control batons. So in the floor show, I break out my batons and twirl them.
So on your resume, it's listed under special skills.
It's like the first special skills, twirling batons.
Is that lucrative? Do you get a lot of callbacks from that?
No. I have to like beg to twirl them in shows. Like, please let me twirl my batons. It's usually only when you're a tranny, you know, because I also did pageant, mm-hmm. Bill Russell's Pageant, the musical, and I played Miss Texas, and she tap danced in cowboy boots, and I added baton twirling into it, so.
Oh, wait, is tranny something we're allowed to say? I thought we weren't allowed to say that anymore.
Oh, is that like an un-PC thing now? Oh, I'm sorry. But I love I Am Kate, that new show. It's fabulous. I'm transvestite, I'm sorry. Tranny. Although I told my granny what tranny chasers were, and now she's really afraid that I've got lots of tranny chasers in Greenville. So, you know, a girl can dream.
Well, as long as you don't go into the gay bar and dress up as a drag queen, I think you'll be okay.
I'll be okay, yeah. But like, I'm totally like a guy. Like, I mean, I usually have a full beard and like chest hair, and I like love being like in a muscle tee and a trucker cap. So this role has definitely been a little bit of getting used to of like, man, it's like, oh my God, it's hard to be a woman and a transvestite.
Well,
so,
Frankenfurter is really not a woman, though. He's a drag queen.
He's fully a transvestite, you know.
Oh,
a man,
really?
Yeah, I'm just a straight transvestite.
Man dressing up as a woman, which is a drag queen.
Yeah, so he has
these terms. I know it's a lot. It's too much.
But I wanted to do like a really glamorous Frankenfurter. So, but I don't tuck. I let that all be.
Whoa! What kind of drag queen doesn't tuck?
He's a transvestite. So transvestites sometimes kind of take masculine and feminine qualities. So it's kind of the best of both. But it's so crazy. I have all these like middle-aged women who have like fallen in love with me in this role. So I was like, oh, I'm going to like pick up a lot of hot guys. But no, it's like all these like women who like wanting to leave their husbands for me. Literally, I had two women say, I'm leaving my husband for you.
Wow. Okay.
So in case I go that way, I've got a few in the bag.
It's like those, you know, Atlanta wives. They all have a secret kinky side.
All right. Yeah. There's a whole genre for all that.
Well, from your photos, you do seem like a very classy Frankenfurter. I love the curls. Well, the dark curls.
Yeah. Well, you know, the director wanted to take it very 70s glam. So we really pushed it in that direction costuming wise, but being very 70s and glamorous and fabulous.
Wait, some details for those who don't know where you're playing this.
So, yeah. So, I'm playing Frankenfurter at the Warehouse Theater in Greenville, South Carolina. And it runs now through Halloween. So, and Greenville's adorable. Come check it out. And then also come see Sleepy Hollow Experience at Serenby Playhouse, my theater company, which is running until Halloween as well. So, you could see both in one trip.
Is it the same Sleepy Hollow that has been on for the... It's your tradition now.
Yeah, so it's actually become our tradition. This is our third year doing it. But because of capacity, we've actually moved it into a different location. So we're working with Adam Koch, who's actually a New York set designer we brought down, and it's just adorable. Mm-hmm. And he is basically creating a skeleton of a town. So we've created this like skeleton of Tarrytown, which allows us to really push a lot of people through it. So it's completely in the woods with these skeletal structures. And then our marketing campaign is, you know, if you thought the Headless Horseman was scary in the stables, wait till you meet him in the middle of the woods. So we're trying to make it creepier this year. You know, and y'all named us one of the top five Halloween shows last year. So we've got that stuck on all of our marketing materials as well. So we're bragging about that for sure.
We're happy to help. We advocate scaring the hell out of your audiences.
Absolutely.
You know,
scare them good.
I know, especially if you can take them into the woods and have a guy on a horse there.
With no head. Yeah.
Anyhow, actually, the final thing I wanted to ask you was, since you're an actor who became a producer and director and now artistic director, like, what tips do you have for actors on empowering themselves? Since in the theater, that's not usually something that actors can do.
I would say do it. You know, if you have a passion for it, just never take no for an answer. And if there's not an opportunity for you to get hired as a director, create your own opportunity. That was what was really drilled into me in graduate studies, is that don't sit around waiting for something. Just make it happen. Get a reading together with friends. Invite people that can see your work. You know, it's all about the relationships you have with people. Who do you know that can help you? And then also create your own opportunities. You cannot sit around and wait for opportunity to happen. You know, constantly be working.
Right.
Period. no excuse for not creating work. You can do it in a living room and get friends and give them some wine. Like there's literally no excuse not to. So, you know, you can think and dream huge, but then, learn to crawl before you run.
Right. And don't think that a theater space is just a space that's inside a proscenium.
You can, I mean, you know, Ceremony Playhouse is a living example. You can do theater anywhere. You can, and theater began outside. It's like, you know, bring it back to where it began. And really surround yourself with artists that you trust and love, and create a family. So again, we're not doing this for all the money. We're doing it because we love it and we're passionate about it. And just consistently create good work. You know, for us in year six, everything's just kind of blown up this year, but I firmly believe it's because of the work we've done over the past 6 years to get us to this place.
Right. And if you do it well, you'll get an American Theater Wing grant.
Yes. Even you can have an American Theater Wing grant.
That's fantastic.
Regional Tony's next, folks. Hashtag make it happen.
Thank you so much.
And thank you.
And how can people find you? Do you have a Twitter account?
We have everything. Okay. So we have our website, SaramyPlayhouse.com. Then also follow us on Facebook, Saramby Playhouse. Our Twitter account is onstage, Saramby, and Saramby is S-E-R-E-N-B-E. Then we also have Saramby Playhouse Instagram, Pinterest, and YouTube. We're huge on social media, so please check out everything we have going on.
And if you friend Brian, he will show you the photos of him as Frankenfooter.
Yeah, so Brian, B-R-I-A-N, Cloudus, C-L-O-W-D-U-S. And I'm also currently taking husband applications.
Yes, because my favorite thing on Brian's resume is he was named one of Atlanta's most eligible bachelors by Jezebel magazine.
You were just waiting for that, weren't you?
Yes.
You were saving that.
So if you want to do theater outside, Brian's your man.
Yes.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And we're back with a few recommendations of things we've either seen or read or thought about that we want to tell you about. Deep, you can start it off.
All right. I'm going to recommend two articles that I read. They're both from Grantland, and one is a really good profile of Annie Baker. Well, and Grantland, I thought they were just a sports writing website, but they actually do a lot of long-form features just about general culture. And
yeah, they've been doing that for a while.
Yeah, but they haven't covered theater in a very long time.
No, they don't cover
And so in the last like 2 weeks, they've covered Annie Baker, and then they also covered Hamilton because everyone and their mother is covering Hamilton. But they did a very good interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda. And for the Annie Baker thing, my favorite quote from that is when she said, "You realize after working with a lot of artistic directors and producers that so many of them don't have a real opinion." And so it's a very pithy little interview and, I mean, profile.
She's not going to name any names there. Anyway, sounds good.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently,
yes,
Lin had to kick out one of his friends so that an unnamed rapper can get into Hamilton.
Yeah.
And then the rapper never showed up. And so now my boyfriend and I are trying to figure out who the rapper was. It may have been Jay-Z. I don't know. But
yeah.
That's a mystery.
There's a lot to choose from, right? Susie?
I'm going to recommend a movie. Actually, I'm going to recommend two movies.
Wait,
both have theater ties.
What is this thing called movie?
A movie. Both of them have theater ties, and I loved both of them a lot. The first one I'm going to recommend is Leslie Headland, playwright Leslie Headland's new movie, Sleeping with Other People, which is kind of like a Nora Ephron-esque modern-day dialogue-driven romantic comedy that I just adored. It has Alison Brie and Jason Sudeikis. Really, really great. I mean, I love Leslie Headland ever since I saw Bachelorette at Second Stage Uptown, which then became a classic movie. And then she did Assistance at Playwrights Horizons. And now, you know, she lives in LA and writes pilots and movies. But this is a good movie, so I recommend seeing it if it's still in theaters. The other movie that I saw recently that I really loved and has sort of a theater tie was Nancy Meyers' The Intern. There's a lot. Bernie Telsey, who's a big Broadway casting director, cast it. So there's a lot of Broadway faces that pop up. Andrew Rannells has a pretty big part. I think Elena Shadow is an extra. Max von Essen is an extra. A lot of Broadway faces. Really great. Don't go shopping for home appliances afterwards. You'll have no money left because it's Nancy Meyers' production design and it looks gorgeous. And it was really sweet and a really feel-good movie, so I recommend it.
De Niro and
Anne Hathaway.
That sounds really creepy.
Why is it? It's not a romance.
Oh, so they don't get it on?
No.
I'm sorry. The ads make it look like
the story the
creepiest
of the-
fucking May September romance ever.
It is so good. It okay, is sorry. Not a romance.
Sorry.
I'm not gonna put it past
Hollywood. If it's Nancy Myers, why isn't it a romance?
It's not a romance. It's about a friendship.
Oh.
It's about a retiree it's who's bored, who goes back to this intern program to fill his days.
Okay,
and
sorry.
And this new entrepreneur who, like, is has in over her head learned a thing from an old business guy.
It would not be the first time Hollywood has done that kind
well,
of
you
thing.
Know, someone's got to give. It had, you know, Jack Nicholson and Amanda Peet in a romance. I get it. She's done it before.
Although that was self-aware a little bit, sort of.
Well, yes, because then he ended up with right. Diane Keaton at the end.
Yeah, but then sorry. But then it's there was okay. that Vulture infographic where they show, like, as milk. As
this movie is not that.
Age up, like the, right. their romances stay the same. They're yes. still going for girls in their 20s.
I 100% agree with Rob. That would be creepy. This movie is not about an 80-year-old man getting it on with a 30-year-old woman.
80? Robert De Niro is not 80.
How old is he? He's 70 in the movie.
He might be pushing 70, but there's no way Robert De Niro.
He's got to be older than my parents. And my parents are almost 70.
I don't know about that. Anyway.
72.
72. Okay.
Really?
All right.
Okay, well, it's very good. Go see Sleeping with Other People and The Intern.
Sounds good. Sounds good. So since we have you here still, Russ and Allison, why don't you, Allison, I'll let you go first this time.
All right.
Anything you want to recommend to us, to the world?
I'm going to recommend The City of Chicago. I went to Chicago for the first time last week, and I had such a great time. I saw a lot of awesome theater, one of which was American Idiot at the Hypocrites. It's now running through October 25th. It was my first experience with seeing American Idiot on stage, but I was telling my colleagues here that the album, Green Day's album, now makes a lot more sense to me. It was amazing, and all of the actors were also playing the instruments. Everyone was on stage for a lot of it. It was a huge cast. I mean, there was 17 people, but it was amazing how they you know, brought to life this album.
Was it
that
in
I
a
had
big
no
space?
It was a small space.
A small space. And so I'm wondering, was it a full rock
there was
sound
a,
and an experience?
Yes. Yeah. There was a full band.
Yeah.
And then as their scenes would come down or their songs, they would step down off this platform. And it was incredible. There were just, it was a small space, but there were rafters that they would hang off of jump around. And it really felt like you were at a rock concert.
Cool.
And didn't we feature one, the main actor in it, the transgendered actor in our 25 people to watch?
Malik White, read about.
Malik White plays St. Jimmy, and you can read about Malik in our 20 theater workers to watch online.
Roll call, our new feature, yes. Indeed. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. Russ, what do you have? Anything you've seen lately that you want to recommend? Or
yeah, I will take a cue from Allison and second the recommendation of The City of Chicago.
Okay,
I haven't been in a while, but
Chicago has great theater. Who
I've
knew?
Heard about that.
I
who knew?
Chicago is my town. You cannot take Chicago away from me.
I'm reinforcing your love of that city. I'm agreeing with you. That's all.
Great.
And I'll just throw in Court Theater, which does good work as well. I got to check them out for the first time last winter.
The Native Son, the Nambi
Kelly.
I've seen that picture a lot. And that's going to have its L.A. premiere at Antilles. Am I right? Do I have the right company there? Anyway, I think I just read that in our season listing. I am just going to recommend sort of not a thought experiment. Let's just say there's a piece on HowlRound by Louis Douthat, the dramaturg at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And one of the big controversies this week was that Oregon Shakespeare Festival has announced that they're going to translate all 39 plays attributed to Shakespeare, which just means including a couple that are of dubious authorship, along with the ones that no one really questions, except for crazy people. But Oregon Shakespeare has been treated as crazy people for suggesting that Shakespeare plays should or could be translated into, quote, modern English. I think I've read enough about it to believe it on the merits that there's a case for it. I'm skeptical still of the results, but I was sent a script of Timon of Athens, the very first one, Kenneth Cavender, a British translator and author. He was the first one they did. I guess I would just say, take a look at the Louis Douthat makes a decent case for, you know, something that she's calling translation, which might a different word, adaptation might be a better word, transliteration, something like that. It's an amazing roster of playwrights, of contemporary playwrights, very diverse group. And, I guess what I'm saying, recommending people wait and see. There's been a lot of, people that they're suggesting it's almost like, the people are suggesting the altering the Bible, you know, and,
isn't the Message version of the Bible just translating the Bible into common English?
Right. Well, I mean, as many have said, the difference is obviously that Shakespeare, a playwright's words are his work, right? I mean, it's Shakespeare.
A writer's words are their work.
Yeah, but then people translate Chekhov all the time and just foreign languages. And and some people can't even understand Elizabethan English.
Well, the question is, there are a certain number of words which have changed their meanings. You know, yes, you can understand it if you read it on the page, and most of the time you can get what's going on stage if it's well directed.
Right. But if it's not, like, I saw Wooster Group's Cry Trojans, and it was Troilus and Cressida, but I had a very difficult time.
Well, nothing against the Wooster Group or the problems you have with that production, but Wooster Group is not the way to experience Shakespeare.
Yeah, it wasn't the racial appropriation thing. It was the fact that just the way they acted it was very, like, a stay-in.
I mean, I also
that's the style of it, but it's really
Hamlet
hard.
Their Hamlet with the film in the background was amazing, but was not the way I would recommend experiencing Hamlet. You would not know anything that's going on because that's the Wooster Group. What I'm interested in is the experience. The best case I've heard is that we can talk about this probably in a future thing after we all write about it. But the experience that bilingual speakers have of seeing it translated into French or Spanish or another language, and they suddenly get the play because, you know, those. They're translated into, but a translation is different from the original. I mean, years ago I talked to Tracy Letts and Sarah Rule about their translations of Chekhov, and they admit that, you know, translation is not the original play. It is an adaptation by nature. It's, you cannot get the poetry in the same way, but.
I mean, we have a piece coming out online soon in a few weeks about translating Shakespeare into sign language, like.
Right, which is a whole other language.
It's a whole other language, like.
And I would imagine the folks who see that Shakespeare in that translation are going to understand it, right?
Exactly.
In a way that, so I think that that is the impulse that led to, there's a Silicon Valley guy named Dave Hitz, HITZ, who funded this, and his dream is to have that experience. He loves Shakespeare, he's read it, he knows it backwards and forwards, but he would love to sit in an audience and just experience it as a play without having to sort of do that adjustment. I mean, I think we all know, like, when you watch Shakespeare, even a good Shakespeare, it takes a few minutes to sort of, like, get into the rhythm and adjust. Yeah. Adjust. It's like a filter, putting it on a filter. Yeah,
that's why I can't watch all the time. It literally hurts my brain to watch Shakespeare.
Well, it's like when we did that piece with Meg Morashnik and Karen Coonrod about Meg said, and she's like, I wrote this new language for my Elizabethan modern play because, like, when I see Shakespeare, I'm really proud of myself when I get a joke.
Right.
It takes work.
Too.
Well, you know, Shakespearean jokes, I mean, there's a lot of debate about whether they're actually even funny at all when they're told. I mean, not the situational humor, which is great, but the gags in which people on stage usually just grab their crotch and, you know, and mug, you know, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of jokes. I remember, I'll just give one example and then we'll end this, charade. There's a production of Romeo and Juliet Mercutio. There's a line in there where he refers to a pump. And he did a little, like, bump and grind, like, you know, sexual. I looked it up just because, out of curiosity, he was referring to a shoe. It was a word for a pump. Like,
yeah, I associate that with shoe.
Well, but in context, it wasn't clearly a shoe. It was like, yes, it was the context you would a pump. It wasn't saying, I'll put on my high heel pumps. It wasn't that clear, but it was like something in the pump. I can't quote it.
Isn't it the director's job to tell him that's not the context?
You would think so, but I would just say that there's too many Shakespearean clowns who rely on just, like, mugging. And I mean, partly because, you know, Comedy of Errors, for instance, how do you get through that play without just people hitting each other? It's not really that funny without that.
Well, it's in the play too, a little bit of hitting each other.
That is true. But, you know, you can add a lot of hitting and the play survives. And I think that, the Shakespeare plays will survive this translation effort. I think, that's enough debate for now. And, I hope you look forward to a great, season, and we'll be back in a couple weeks with another off script.